in a special remote broadcast. This is First Coast Connect on the go, live from the beautiful downtown. From the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. Hey, everybody. We have a great crowd here this morning. Thanks so much for being here, and thanks for listening wherever you are in the First Coast right now. I'm Melissa Ross. We're coming to you live for the full hour today from this incredible historic building, the former Hayden Burns Library. It was recently reborn, of course, as the epicenter of the local nonprofit community. A big thanks to all of the nonprofits who helped make this live remote possible and for being here in the audience today. We really appreciate you being here and all you do for this community. Now, later, we're going to hear from two thought leaders for nonprofits in this area. Also this morning, find out about some major legislation passed into law in Florida. And then later on, comedian Paula Poundstone on her big show this weekend at the Florida Theater. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, several members of our own Duval delegation played major roles this legislative session in new measures affecting everything from kids to juvenile justice and more. We're kicking things off right now with a bipartisan panel as we welcome Representatives Mia Jones and Charles McBurney to the stage. How about a big hand? So good to have you both with us. Representative Mia Jones, let's begin with you. What do you think was the most important piece of legislation passed this session, particularly as relates to children? That's a big concern to the local nonprofit community.
For me, it would definitely be the expungement bill and giving the opportunity for our young people to have a second chance. We know that we all, as young people, make mistakes, and when our young people get into the system, it's very difficult for them to get out. And so the expungement bill allows for them to have their records expunged, to give them a chance to go on with their lives. And so we're very excited about that. They'll have the opportunity to apply for expungement and then move forward.
And Charles McBurney, you were heavily involved as well in a mental health standardization bill this year. It standardizes, among other things, the use of mental health courts, expands the scope of community-based care organizations, a major piece of legislation. Can you share a little bit about that with our audience?
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks for having us and all the nonprofit groups. Thank you for what you do for our community. You don't get enough credit for what you do out there, and no one can say more often thanks. Thanks for what you do. Mental health was one of the most important, if I think probably the most important bill that came out of the Judiciary Committee of the Florida House. It greatly changed the relationship between mental health and our criminal justice system. We found that 19 times more persons with serious mental illnesses were in our jails and prisons than in all of our psychiatric hospitals combined. And as such, we, beginning as a committee and then working with our Senate partners, we were able to come up with the most comprehensive legislation dealing with mental health in the courts in 45 years. And one of those components dealt with kids, because we had all the stakeholders that came before the Judiciary Committee, of which I chaired, and one of those groups was dealing with juveniles, the Department of Juvenile Justice, and some of the advocates for juveniles, and saying how important that component is. And so the mental health courts aspect includes juveniles, but also includes pretrial intervention and post-adjudicatory assistance for juveniles caught up in the system who suffer from serious mental illness.
And let's now welcome Senator Audrey Gibson to the stage as well. Audrey Gibson, so good to have you with us. When we look at the legislation that passed this year, there, of course, were a lot of bills that didn't pass. When you look back on the session in Tallahassee, in particular legislation related to children, what caught your eye and what would you have liked to see go through that maybe didn't make it through the process?
And thank you so much for having me this morning, and good morning to everyone. One of the bills, you know, sometimes you lose sight, particularly if it goes from the Senate to the House, but one of the bills that I hoped had made it through was the issue of direct filing of juveniles, as well as the expunction bill that Senator Dietert had, which also related to young people. Education bill, actually, that I wasn't a friend of, that allows for open enrollment, which I think is going to be problematic not only for school districts but for children as well. And there was one more. I'll think of it.
There's a lot to keep track of. What about this issue of school choice? Charles McBurney, Mia Jones. HB 7029 requires that beginning in the year 2017, each district and charter school must adopt a controlled open enrollment plan. It would allow a student to enroll in any public school in the state. What do you think about that?
I did not support the bill. I do not believe that is the direction that we need to be going in. When we look at the system that we've put in place, we have to realize that we have a foundation that's been set. And a part of that foundation in our public school system is knowing how many kids are going to be there, so you know how you fund the programs and how you can move forward to ensure that you're providing a quality education. You can't do that if all of a sudden you lose thousands of students from Duval to St. John's County because their parents want them to go to St. John's County schools because their schools are grading better. And so that was a very disappointing day when we passed that bill, and I think that we are going to see some serious repercussions as a result of it.
Charles McBurney, your thoughts?
Well, this is one where we may disagree. I think choices and giving parents and children's choices is extremely important. What we've tried to do in the legislature over the last number of years is given these opportunities and choices for children. I've seen it very much during the last 9 years that I've been in the legislature. Programs such as virtual schools, for example, was something where they said the sky was going to fall, and yet that turned out to be a tremendous program for parents and children. And it shouldn't be about the schools, it should be about the children and giving the children the best opportunities. Now, this particular legislation gives yet another choice. It's not an open-ended type of legislation, by the way. I mean, there has to be an opening there. There are priorities that are given to the neighborhood children and the neighborhood schools. But it does give parents and children, if the opportunity avails itself, of a choice of where they want to send their children to school. And to me, that's got to be the first priority. What's best for the kids?
Audrey Gibson.
Thank you. And certainly there's nothing negative about choice. There's nothing negative about wanting the best for your child, but the problem, the inherent problem is, kids will go to their neighborhood schools, and sometimes therein lies the problem. Some kids will be trapped, and that is certainly inequality when it comes to education, and it does, again, as Representative Jones pointed to, talk about budgeting. And so when kids start to leave a district, remember we have average daily attendance, schools are funded that way. And so those neighborhood schools that some folks are trying to protect, and we might talk about that a little, have a little different take on how that should work out. Those schools will end up closing. You cannot have schools that have a diminished population of students and expect them to exist. The other issue starts to become transportation. Their parents, yes, they would like to have their kids go to maybe a different school in an entirely different county, but then transportation becomes an issue. There is nothing provided in the legislation about transportation and expectations and income levels. There is a big mixture of things that can impact children negatively, I think.
Now, in a moment, we'll go to a few questions from you, our live audience here at the Downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center, as we welcome to this special remote broadcast Representatives Mia Jones and Charles McBurney and Senator Audrey Gibson. I would be remiss if I didn't ask both Senator Gibson and Representative Jones. Both of your names have come up in recent weeks as possible contenders for the District 5 congressional seat, long occupied, of course, by Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Depending on the outcome of her challenge to a redistricting of that seat and a House ethics investigation, both of you have been discussed as potential successors. I'd like to get you both on the record. Are you considering running for that seat? Mia Jones.
Wow, I didn't see that coming, Melissa.
Well, I didn't lead off with it, but I would not be doing my job if I didn't ask.
Yes, you didn't ask. Absolutely. I believe that you have to keep all opportunities open, and it would definitely be something that I would definitely consider doing.
Senator Gibson.
Well, certainly, as a member of the redistricting committee, I'm intimately familiar with the process as well as the map. And just to correct the one thing that you said is that, of course, Congresswoman Brown has represented our area, but the district is not the same district that was previously represented except for a portion of Jacksonville. And so the first thing that has to play out is what will the court do? The attorneys for Congresswoman Brown were to deliver some arguments to support the movement or the redistricting of the redistricting of CD5, and then the other side has until April 11th to, of course, present their arguments. And so the devil's in the details, and that is what will the court rule? It's the federal court. I will say that certainly changing CD5 back to the way it is today impacts at least all districts, at least to Tampa. And so I'm not sure that they're willing to do that. And so all that said, first is whether or not the Congresswoman decides that she wants to run in CD5. Secondly would be, yes, I have said and I continue to say that I would definitely consider running in that district. I believe that Jacksonville, Duval County is the anchor for that district. We have all of the business here, all of the port is here, the entire economic development for CD5 rests in Duval, and I think it's critical that a person from Jacksonville represents.
Well, breaking some news today on the show, how about that? All right. Now it's your chance to connect directly with our legislative leadership here in Duval County. Don't be shy. Step up to the mic. Who's got a question? Come on up. And please give your name and go for it.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jim Clark with Daniel. And one of the things that, Mia Jones, that you did so well was House Bill 7087, which allowed for telemarketing. There still are some flaws in that, in particular, psychotropic medications. And can you tell us if there's any additional things down the road? I know you were not as pleased entirely with that bill, and there are some fixes, particularly as it relates to, in our area in particular, we have a lack of psychiatrists that are in this area, and telemarketing indeed will be helpful. But can you tell us some things in this next legislation that we should be looking at, and can you address the issue of psychotropics?
Psychotropics, no. But I will say that the telemedicine and telehealth bill was a critical piece of legislation for me. I've been working on this for the past 4 years, and this is the first year that we've been able to get it out of both the House and the Senate. And we recognize that we have a limited number of providers. I want to thank Representative Pigman for his commitment to making sure that we got some additional movement with telehealth. And one of the things that is a blessing for us is that because we have a limited number of psychiatrists and providers, opening up to telemedicine provides an opportunity for us to be able to get our young people and our entire community the help that they need. And so we're very excited about that. What I'm anticipating will happen is that we will also have a task force that will look at all of the services that are being provided through telehealth across our state. We have a great deal of them. I was in Houston on a panel, and there were over 14 representatives from Florida that were providing services. And so we know that we're providing services outside of our state to other states. We want to be able to make sure that we're maximizing the opportunity within our state. And so we look forward to seeing that expansion take place, not just in psychiatry and psychology, psychological areas and behavioral health, but also as we look at stroke, the work that's being done in neuroscience, all of those things are very impactful here in our community with St. Vincent's over in Orange Park, as well as with Mayo Clinic and their stroke program, and at Nemours and Wolfson's Hospitals with their programs as well, that they're providing services all over the state of Georgia for young people and making sure that they have the level of care that's necessary to ensure the best quality of life for them.
All right, another question from the audience. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. My name is Josh Rosenblatt. I'm a proud taxpaying citizen here, and I work in schools and care a lot about the schools. You guys make a lot of policies and legislate things based on schools. So my question to you all is, when is the last time you've been in a school? How often do you go? And how does
And you're with City Year, right?
Oh, well, yes, yeah. I am with City Year.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I see your name tag there.
I have a name tag, yeah. And, you know, how much do those experiences inside of the schools affect the policies and stuff and your guys' opinions on things?
All right. That was a mouthful. Charles McBurney, you want to start?
Well, it doesn't hurt that my wife is a teacher at a public school in Jacksonville, and I don't think she's listening because she's working. I've always been very involved with the schools in my district, serving in a school advisory council. I was chairman of that actually at my wife's school, and then at one of the kids' schools at Mandarin High School. And of course, I've had the opportunity to visit a number of schools in the district, and you get to see it actually reinforces my belief in our school system. Makes me proud of the people who are working in our schools day in, day out. You've got a lot of dedicated people who I think do great work. And it's one of the things that I've really enjoyed during my tenure as a state representative.
Senator Audrey Gibson.
Thank you. And I'm so sorry that the City Year funding got vetoed in the budget, but maybe next year. Since I was elected in 2002, and in the National Conference of State Legislatures had a program called Take Your Legislator Back to School. So every year since then, I have been to at least three or four of the schools in my district. I choose elementary, middle, and high school to do something called representative government. And so I make all the kids in the classrooms honorary members of the legislature, and we pretend to pass a bill mostly dealing with lunch. And it's very exciting. you can just imagine what the menus end up looking like. And it's a very exciting process, and it's fun to watch the kids get into it, and I choose who's going to be the Senate president, who's going to be the speaker, and they pick sides and votes. And so the shorter answer to your question is I've been in every school in my first my House district and then my Senate district, so the numbers increase every year since 2002.
And Mia Jones.
I am a product of the public school system, and I am a 100% supporter of the public school system. So on a regular basis, I'm in my schools. And one of the things that I did as an elected official started on the city council was to make sure that I had a relationship with our principals in each of my schools, and then to be able to hear from them what problems they were having, what things they were seeing, and then bringing them together so that wherever I could help them, I was able to do that. And we continue to do that today. When we go into the schools, it's an opportunity for me to let the young people know in the district that I represent that I come from the district And so they get to see someone who has gone through the some of the same schools that they've gone through, and they get very excited about that. And so I take great pride in being able to be an active and involved member of what's going on in our public school system.
All right, thank you. And let's take one more question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
My name is Myra Martello, and I work with the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. I would like to know what of the legislation that was approved, how is it that you're including a diverse perspective of our students? What happens with their needs, the specific needs of English language learners, special needs students, gender orientation? What can you tell us about that diverse perspective of our children?
Anybody?
Okay. I'm trying to think if I remember anything that passed related to ESC. I don't think
so specifically, but what I will say is that the legislature is pretty diverse when you start to look at the representation that exists from South Florida through North Florida. And so we do have the benefit of that. I don't think it's something that's overlooked. I just don't think it's something that is specifically addressed on a regular basis in a particular bill for this previous session.
Okay.
One of the things that you mentioned was dealing with disabilities, and there was some legislation that did pass providing educational eligibility waivers for developmental disabilities, particularly dealing with Down syndrome. And the legislature passed on a bipartisan, unanimous basis, very broad legislation dealing with the overall developmental disabilities and providing education and training opportunities for those with disabilities. Can you mention that specifically? Yeah. So,
how about a big round of applause for our Duval delegation? Thank you so much, Representatives Mia Jones and Charles McBurney and Senator Audrey Gibson, live here on the show today. We thank you so much for all you do and for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
And we need to note, Reggie Fullwood, our other local representative, his family had a medical emergency, so that's why he couldn't be with us today. But we'll talk a little bit about some legislation he was involved in later on the show. Keep listening, because there's much more still to come here on this special broadcast, live and on the go from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center.
Hi, this is Jessica Evans, a proud board member of WJCT. It's time to give. When you donate now to WJCT, you are supporting all of your favorite public radio programming, and you're also helping us shorten our pledge drive. Our promise to you is that we'll end this fundraiser as soon as we hit our $80,000 goal. Plus, the earlier you give, the better your chances of winning in our prize drawings. Learn more by visiting WJCT.org or by calling 904-353-9528.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT. Your community, your world.
Memories press between the pages of my mind. Memories sweeten through the ages just like.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait, because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
And welcome back to our special show, a live broadcast on the go for the full hour this morning from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. Good morning, everybody. Hey. We have a fantastic live audience here to be part of this special program today, and we thank you so much. Lots of folks from our vibrant local nonprofit community on hand here in the building to be part of this. Thanks so much for being here. You know, Dr. Sherry McGill, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, was instrumental, as many of you know, in transforming the building we sit in, the old downtown Hayden Burns Library, into a thriving and brilliant and beautiful space for 14 local nonprofits. It's been such a journey for the transformation of this building and also for the local nonprofit community. Speaking of which, the Nonprofit Center of Northeast Florida has just come out with its new benefits and compensation survey looking at this area's nonprofit community and trends within it. So here with more, we welcome Sherry McGill, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, and Rena Coughlin, who runs the Nonprofit Center of Northeast Florida. Ladies, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Sherry, let's begin with you. It was quite a long road to transform this building into what it is today, which is just a gorgeous space. Tell us a little bit about that progress and that journey, because you saw it through from beginning to end, and now here we all sit today in what's been part of the resurgence of downtown Jacksonville in this space.
Well, it's been a labor of love. It was a tough road, as you suggest. In the late 1990s, the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund participated as a small financial partner in a project that's similar to this in Wilmington, Delaware. You might know that the DuPonts were from Wilmington. Mrs. DuPont is buried there, and it's a community where we make a lot of grants. So we are in and out of this building called the Community Services Building on a regular basis, and it is a home for multiple nonprofits that operate in Delaware. It's been a dream of mine and of the staff and trustees of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund from the time that we participated in that project to try to do something similar here. Very different. In that case, the DuPont company deeded the property to the Longwood Foundation. In this case, we had to purchase the property. So we really are the financial instrument that invested in this property. But it's a vision that we collected from visiting other places, seeing how other communities were bringing their nonprofit sector together. So I've known about this, Melissa, really since the mid to late 1990s. I spent a good decade walking around downtown. Our nonprofit partners don't know this. I'm not sure how much my trustees know. But I spent a good decade walking around downtown Jacksonville. I've always worked in downtown Jacksonville on the North Bank. I've been in and out of multiple buildings that are vacant, that are just treasures if somebody would love them. So this project, as you suggest, has multiple purposes. Mm-hmm. The primary purpose is to create greater financial efficiencies for our sector. Giving is down. I don't think giving is going to grow. These folks do yeoman work in terms of not just serving people, but fostering healthy communities. You cannot have a healthy community without a healthy nonprofit sector. It flat out doesn't exist. What we don't understand about that is kind of stunning to me. Mm-hmm. So this project has multiple purposes. The primary purpose is to bring a collection of nonprofit players together to drive down their operating costs so that they can serve more people. Need is growing in our community. I don't see that ending anytime soon, quite frankly, because the wage structure is low. Which you're going to hear from Rena, that's true in our sector as well. So it's been a long haul, but I'm just thrilled with where we are.
And Rena Coughlin, let's talk about that. You just released a compensation and benefits survey looking at wages and the overall health of the nonprofit sector in this area. What were some of the key findings?
Well, Melissa, it was about time we did this. This is the first ever. And if you think that there's 60,000 of us working in the nonprofit sector and we don't have sort of a benchmarking instrument, as I said, about time. And we found some things you might expect, that the nonprofit sector is female dominated. About 78% of those 60,000 people are women. Well, surprisingly, though, women are still paid less than men in the, at least at the, excuse me, the management levels.
So, and even in a female-dominated sector like the nonprofit community, the wage gap persists.
It does.
That's incredibly frustrating.
But it's closer than it is
in the corporate world.
Correct. And yeah. So one of the challenges that we're taking on here in the nonprofit sector is to be the first industry locally to close that gap. I think that we have the best chance of doing it. Some of the other things that, I mean, there's good news in there. There's... but I don't want to dwell on the bad news, but I do think we have to own up to the fact that our sector is not very diverse, at least in its leadership. At the CEO level, only 10% of the CEOs are non-white. In what's very important in our sector, which is fund development, similarly, only 11% of those folks are non-white. So those are two key areas that, again, I think we could work on.
Sure.
And then, in general, we do have some very low-wage positions, and one of the reasons we did this study is that we wanted to make sure that the folks who work in the nonprofit sector have the opportunity to live a decent life, and we want to look more closely at the gap between what you might call a living wage and a fair wage, and what we are currently paying for a lot of our positions in the nonprofit sector, because I think it's important that we attract the best and the brightest to tackle the absolutely toughest issues mm-hmm. that we're dealing with.
So. Any questions from the live audience for these two thought leaders here in our local nonprofit community? Don't be shy. Oh, come on. Really? Come on, guys. Oh, here comes somebody. No, you're not coming up to ask a question? I can't believe this. Oh, wait, here comes Jim Clark again. Hey, come on up.
One of the things that the nonprofit community feels or sees lots of times is we don't get paid for our service. It's kind of felt that we have to go out and get the philanthropic dollar or depend upon foundations in order to meet our budget type of needs. I would say most of the people in this room today, we don't have pensions. We don't have retirement type of things. We'll probably be working until we're dead. Can y'all speak to that in terms of what sort of things we should do to force government to pay for the service? In fact, there are some grants that require, the government wants us to provide a service, but we have to come up with 10 to 20% of philanthropic dollars in order for us to provide that governmental service.
Sherry McGill.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Thank you, Jim. I very much appreciate the question. So the previous panel, some of our legislative representatives, you may have heard Representative McBurney say thank you to the sector. I leaned over to Rena and said, we don't need thanks, we need funding. I hope that doesn't sound uncharitable, but you know what I'm talking about. But the other thing he said was he commented on, briefly, you may have missed it, he commented on how important nonprofit advocacy was this legislative session to achieve the legislative results that we received. So in the mental health area, Denise Mazzulla and her colleagues were instrumental in advocating for that. In the expungement of juvenile records, Roy Miller and LaWanda Rivora, and some of you in this room, were absolutely instrumental in making sure that happened. So that suggests to me that we have to come together to do a better job at explaining to people who do not want to hear it what this sector does, locally, statewide, and nationally. And it is unconscionable, forgive me, unconscionable that the sector has said to policymakers at the federal, state, and local level, we can do this on the cheap. We cannot do it on the cheap. The state pays you all less than it paid itself to provide the same service, and you do a better job. So we have to organize citizens, we have to organize ourselves, and we cannot be afraid of showing up at city council and at the state legislative level and tell the truth about how much it costs to deliver a service.
Rena.
Well, and I think this is part of a very important conversation about what is a fair price for the services we're delivering. And we have to accept some of the responsibility in the sector. I'm looking at our compensation survey, and some of the very lowest wages are paid to the people who are caring for our children and are caring for our adults who need special care. They are at the very bottom of the wage scale. And so we need to think about where our priorities are in the sector and start demanding, I think, that these conversations take place not just in the government, but also with philanthropies, with corporations, and start thinking about our own responsibilities and leadership around wages, compensation, contractual obligations, and maybe not delivering services if we're not being fairly paid. That's a tough thing for us to say. It's very hard for us to say no. We're not showing up at that daycare. We're not showing up at that senior center. But at some point, if conversations and advocacy fail, maybe demonstrating the importance of the sector does need to take place.
So. Well, we're thrilled to be able to shine a light on what you're doing with this special broadcast, and thank you both so much for being on the program. How about a big hand for Sherry McGill and Rena Coughlin? And we'll be right back with more of our special broadcast live and on the go from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. Be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of a 52-year-old tech reporter who was laid off and then went to work for a tech startup where most of the people were in their 20s and 30s. We talk with Dan Lyons about his new memoir, Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Lyons has also written for the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, California is raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour. New York is set to do the same, but the movement to raise wages faces resistance in more conservative and rural states. What the higher minimum wages could mean for income inequality, employers, and the presidential race.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Aerothang, with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Aerothang. It's a new show, because we're going to do everything we want.
Aerothang. The opposite of nothing.
On the road or at home, chill out with the Electro Lounge, only on 89.9, Tuesday to Saturday nights.
Welcome back to our special broadcast this morning, live and on the go for the full hour from downtown's Jesse Ball DuPont Center with a live audience. Yes. Lots of members of the local nonprofit community here to be part of this morning, and we thank you for joining us. Let's talk a little bit about the state legislative session that just wrapped up in Tallahassee. Our own WJCT reporter Ryan Bank has been tracking the most significant trends and laws that came out of the Capitol, and he joins us now. Ryan Bank, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's nice to feel the energy in the room.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
A little bit different than a quiet studio.
It really is. Yeah, a completely different thing. Well, this session, the legislature managed to finish without melting down. They managed to pass a budget, so a big difference from 2015. What about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, they managed to do what they're constitutionally required to do, which was come up with a budget
right.
and finish on time. It feels like they've been in session for almost an entire year with all these special sessions, redistricting the budget and all this. But we didn't have the same discussion about Medicaid expansion mm-hmm. that we did last year that sort of torpedoed the session and kind of had the House leadership, you know, taking their ball and going home. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a couple of things that are notable about it, and that's that, first of all, we're in an election year. So there's no reason for them to want to get any more bad press than what they've already had in 2015. They need to focus on campaigning. They need to focus on strategy. So it's really not surprising that they finished on time.
Governor Scott didn't get most of his priorities this time.
Right. I mean, he basically didn't get any of them. Mm-hmm. He wanted $250 million in economic incentives, $1 billion in tax cuts, and he didn't get them. And this time, instead of it sort of being the House and the governor versus the Senate, we had, you know, the Senate and the House versus the governor. And he did not get what he wanted, budgetarily speaking. Even some of the bills that he was pushing for, they passed, but they didn't go as far as he would have liked them to go.
Right. Now, let's talk about some pieces that made it through the process that will affect all of us here in our area. In particular, the pension measure pushed by Mayor Lenny Curry. It made its way through the legislature, and now Jacksonville voters will have to vote up or down a referendum on whether to extend the local sales tax over 30 years to cover more than $2 billion in that unfunded pension liability for the city of Jacksonville.
You know, I think at this point, maybe some of our listeners are starting to roll their eyes at how much we talk about this pension bill.
Yeah.
But it is a huge accomplishment on, you know, for Mayor Lenny Curry. It's a huge accomplishment for our delegation, although it was carried by someone who's in Clay County. But it essentially just means that the voters will decide whether or not we want to extend a sales tax that used to go for infrastructure to pay down a debt. And that's still a hard sell. This is not the end of the fight here.
Right. Two members of our local delegation were involved in some measures that elicited strong emotions. The first, Senator Aaron Bean's Pastor Protection Act, so that religious institutions like churches and schools would not have to officiate or participate in same-sex marriages.
Right, and I think the most notable thing about this bill is that we haven't seen the same kind of backlash that we've seen in other states. Georgia passed a probably larger, more sweeping bill that was eventually vetoed by the governor there. Mm-hmm. North Carolina, the bill actually was signed into law. And this is a very toned down version. It essentially only addresses religious institutions and nonprofits. It kind of just reiterates existing law when it comes to whether or not you'll be forced to officiate or participate in a ceremony that you don't agree with. I don't think the Florida legislature will ever be able to get to the point of passing a bill like Georgia's or North Carolina's. And I've got one word for you, Orlando. There's no way with Disney, with Universal. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll see a bill like that get passed.
Right. Representative Lake Ray put forth a bill. It didn't make its way through the process, but it would have slowed down Syrian refugee resettlement in Florida. Representative Reggie Fulwood, who couldn't be with us today, is also proposing a bill that would create Standards for Comprehensive Science-Based Sex Education in Schools.
Right, and it wasn't a surprise for the latter there, Reggie Fullwood's bill, that it didn't get a hearing, really. I mean, it was barely spoken about.
Yeah.
What was maybe slightly surprising was that Representative Lake Ray's bill didn't gain more traction, especially in an election season where immigration and terrorism is taking center stage, the refugee crisis. And I think it was sort of a kind of a political flourish on the part of Ray to sort of throw that in there, you know, especially after mm-hmm. the Florida primary, we saw that, you know, Donald Trump, who has been the staunchest proponent of closing down borders and limiting immigration, won Jacksonville's area handedly.
Always good to have your insights. Thank you so much, WJCT's own Ryan Bank with us.
Thanks.
And we're not finished yet. More still to come on our special broadcast live from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. We'll be right back.
Hey, news reporter Lindsay Kilbride here. Help us finish our fundraiser by Friday so we don't have a traditional pledge drive. We'll stop when we reach our $80,000 goal. Plus, everyone who donates now has a chance to win a Fitbit Blaze, and will also be entered to win our grand prize giveaway for an Apple Watch. Find out more at WJCT.org. Thanks.
Tina Barton is an investigator who tracks down the brains behind massive scams.
We're talking about highly organized criminal enterprises.
But these criminals carry prescription pads, and they're cheating the workers' comp system.
We're talking about doctors who are being driven by greed. This is Hollywood-level stuff.
Next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
And welcome back. It's our live and on-the-go broadcast this hour from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. Hey, audience! Yeah! Thanks so much for sticking with us through this full hour live from downtown Jacksonville, where we celebrate the local nonprofit community. Finally this hour, Dinosaur Mania has taken over one of our most significant nonprofits in town, the Jacksonville Zoo. Destination Dino is the big attraction there. You need to take your kids. You can check this out all the way through 4th of July weekend. Bob Chabot, Director of Horticulture and Facilities with the Zoo and Gardens, joins us now. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
How are you?
Nice to be here.
Now, I haven't had the chance to check this out yet, but we're talking about 25 species of animatronic lifelike dinosaurs throughout this exhibit.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. They're in a different part of the zoo than you've ever seen before, north of our administration building. And it's an interesting walk or tram ride over there into the swampy woods to see our new dinosaurs.
How were these put together? How did this exhibit come to life?
Well, it takes an awful lot of work and a lot of trucks, a lot of heavy equipment, a lot of air hoses and electricity, but it's really come together to create, I think, the best dinosaur exhibit we've done.
And you can't go wrong with kids and dinosaurs, and grown-ups, too. They're eternally
time.
Fascinating.
They're a hit every time.
Yeah.
People just keep coming out to see them.
And what I love about the zoo's programming is you're always coming up with something new and exciting. You've expanded the gardens. What else is happening at the zoo right now?
Oh, we've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up. We're about to build a manatee rehab facility. We'll work with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission and to be able to bring in and rehabilitate injured or cold stress manatees. We're also looking at redesigning our whole Great Apes area to more of an African tropical forest exhibit. So lots of really exciting stuff coming up.
And we've been spending the morning talking about the vibrance and importance of the local nonprofit community. Lots of representatives from that sector are here in our audience right now. So we need to note that the zoo is also a nonprofit with a 100-year-old history in this area.
We've been here 100 years, and it's, I think, one of the most successful public-private partnerships. We're a nonprofit, in fact, but things have been just great for the zoo, and we appreciate the community support.
I need to note as well, of course, WJCT is a nonprofit too, and you can dial 353-9528 to give to us right now.
That's it.
It's our, yeah. Yes. It's our quiet pledge drive. It's going on right now, and we're not even interrupting programming to do it. Summer camps at the zoo, people need to go. They can, their kids can be part of the dino
That's
summer
right.
camp.
They're dino themed right? this summer. So you come out, you get to go out at nighttime and see the dinosaurs with flashlights. Very exciting.
Uh huh. And what else? What else is going on?
What else is going on at the zoo?
Yeah.
Well, you know, our summer is here. Our water park is open.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Lots of exciting events coming up this summer. Earth Day is coming up soon. Party for the Planet. We've got a garden and wine festival coming up the last weekend of April, that April-May bridging weekend.
Uh-huh.
So you can taste wine, hear great music, buy great plants, and garden-related stuff.
So much happening. It's such a vital cultural resource in this community. How about a big hand for Bob Chabot with the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And to everyone here in the audience that works at a local nonprofit, you work so often long hours for not the hugest salaries, and you do vital work. So give yourselves a hand. How about that? Thanks so much for being here, and thanks to everyone who helped bring about this special live remote on-the-go show from the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center. We've loved every minute of it, and we hope to come back soon. That is our show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Our producer is Sean Birch, and our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chepchik. Diane Reams up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on the go on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be back in studio at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day, everyone. Thanks again.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.